I mean, I wrote it for myself in a sense of deciding, I want to learn these things now. I don't want to be on my deathbed working through some of these issues. I actually had patients say that to me and say to me, I just now figured out what life is really about. And they said, I don't have time to tell anyone else. And that's another inspiration for the book. I had a few patients say, would you remember my story and would you write about it? Because you can tell people, I won't be able to. And so part of it was fulfilling that promise to patients as well.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first. Just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today I talk to Dr. Karen Wyatt, a renowned hospice doctor and author of What Really Matters, 7 Lessons for Living from the Stories of the Dying. Now, before you press skip, this is not as heavy and morbid as it sounds. In fact, quite the opposite. This conversation was fun, inspiring, and hopeful. Karen shares stories of people that learned at the very end of their lives the profound lessons about what really matters in life. Their stories about finding our purpose, being present, and the power of forgiveness. Her patients aren't here anymore, but we are. Their words and these lessons are a gift. This conversation isn't about how to die. It's about how to live. Please enjoy Karen Wyatt. Welcome, Karen. This is a conversation I've been looking forward to for a long time. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really delighted to be here with you.
So it's so interesting. I've been reflecting and preparing for this conversation, and I was trying to think about, how do I feel about this, right? Because undoubtedly, as I said, I'm really excited, but I'm also a little anxious, a little nervous, you know, maybe a little unsettled. And I guess that speaks to sort of the complicated relationship that I think a lot of people have with this topic. And it's probably why we don't talk about it. It's kind of infused with how we were grown up, maybe experiences that we've had with people in our lives dying, maybe religion. It's kind of a real mess.
Yeah, that's so true. And it really is pervasive. It's universal. Almost everyone I run into has discomfort over talking about it. And so that's really something we have to work on a bit in order to overcome, because I think it's really primal to us that we have a fear of not existing anymore.
Wow. Yes, that's very profound. And the other thing too is that in reading your book and talking to you in preparation for this, you know, it doesn't have to be a heavy, depressing conversation, right? It can be inspiring, enlightening, which is really a lot about what your whole book is about, which we'll spend a lot of time talking about. But it's this idea that it doesn't have to be scary. And the only way to get through that fear, I guess, is to just take the first leap and start talking about it, because it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's so true. And even when I first started hospice, I went in with all the same trepidation and fear, like, why am I doing this? What am I getting mm-hmm. into? And do I really want to step this direction? And so I learned on the job that, oh, it's not what I thought it was at all. And I saw the beauty in being with someone as they are in their last moments of life and how much we can learn from that.
That's a great segue, because I didn't really know what hospice was until fairly recently. Like, I'm in my early 50s. It was probably in my late 40s when somebody close to me was terminally ill and they went into hospice for the last piece of their life. My first experience with dying was my dad, who died from cancer 30 years ago, and he died in a hospital. And I didn't know that there were any other options. And so, and also when I'm talking to people kind of in preparation for this conversation, yeah, people either, oh yeah, I knew somebody in hospice, or people are like, what is hospice? I don't really understand it. And so can you just clarify like what that means to you?
Sure. 'Cause hospice care, it's really specialized care for a person at the very end of life. And here in the US, it's most often provided in the in the person's home with their family members caring for them. Whereas I know in Canada, there are more inpatient facilities that patients can go to receive the care. But it differs from other medical care because the focus is on keeping the patient comfortable in body, mind, and spirit. So it's this really whole person care that looks at every aspect of the person's being and doesn't just focus on a physical illness or trying to cure an illness. It's really just trying to support the person and their family members as they go on this last journey of life. So there's symptom relief involved, you know, giving them medications for any physical symptoms. But we also have a chaplain and a social worker who address emotional issues that come up or spiritual issues that are present. And so it's amazing care. And actually, we should be getting this kind of care in all of medicine for every type of illness we had. Someone should be paying attention to us as a whole person. But in hospice is where that actually does happen because there's a whole team of people caring for each patient.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting the contrast between the beginning part of our life, you know, the maternity experience. I'm sure it, you know, it's not perfect, but the amount of care and thought that goes into that part of the experience is in contrast to the other end of it.
Yeah, think of all the books and the training that people receive
right
for birth. Yeah.
So if somebody I know, or me, I guess, like if I was diagnosed and it was like, at what point do I go into hospice and how does that process start in terms of the conversations with the patient and with the family?
Well, here in the U.S., hospice care is limited to the last 6 months of life. So it's really the doctor's responsibility to determine when the patient is eligible and at that point where they can receive that benefit. But in Canada, I believe it's a much longer period of time. And so we have this limitation here in the U.S. that makes it a little harder for people to get admitted at the right time. The other problem we have is patients could be admitted sooner than they are. Here in the U.S., a lot of times they don't get admitted until the last week or two of life, which is a very short time. But ideally, it's the person's physician who talks with the family and patient and says, you know, we no longer have options to try to cure the illness that you have. And we believe that you are on this trajectory that is going to end in death. And hospice care or palliative care is the best way for you to receive care now to make sure you're comfortable, to make sure you can deal with all the issues that are going to come up for you and your loved ones at the very end of life. So ideally, it's the physician, though a family could decide that they want to know more and start asking questions, and they can request that their doctor refer them into hospice care.
And when you're having those first conversations, what do you think people are most surprised to learn about what they're about to experience?
Well, a lot of people have a very negative idea of what hospice is. And so it requires some education, and they're surprised when they find out, it isn't just, you're not just going to go there and be heavily drugged and kept in a coma until you die. Like, you go there and actually hospice workers help you live the best way you possibly can at the end of your life. And that as part of our hospice team, we helped a family go to Disneyland because that was their dream, to go to Disneyland one last time. You know, we've helped people go on fishing trips and take an art class and do, you know, we help them fulfill some of their long time wishes and dreams for their life. I think that's totally surprising to people. They never expected that there would actually be a whole team of people who really care about what their life means to them and what they wanted to accomplish with their life.
Yeah. Again, my only real experience with this kind of thing was my dad, you know, a bunch of years ago. What you just described very quickly is very different from what I experienced. And I don't remember hospice ever being an option, something we ever talked about. I mean, I was young. I was, you know, it was obviously a pretty hard time, but that's fascinating. I had no idea it included all of that.
Well, it just depends on the hospice workers who are there and how you know, how motivated they are, but also the patients have to get admitted early enough in the course of their illness that they mm-hmm. are, that they still have the energy and the physical capacity to do certain things. But if they do, and they want to, there are things they want to fulfill before they die, then hospice workers can help them accomplish that, which is a total surprise to most people.
Yeah. I mean, I know you've got some incredible stories and I do want to hear some of those, but you alluded to something earlier that I wanted to circle back on. When I talk to people in sort of preparation for this podcast, I get a variety of reactions. One is, oh my God, that sounds amazing. The other is, why on earth would you want to talk about this? And I think we all find ourselves on that spectrum, depending on how we feel about what's going on in our lives at the time. But the one universal thing is, how on earth does somebody get into this line of work? So how does that happen for you?
For me, it happened. I mean, in my training as a doctor, I didn't really learn anything about hospice care. I actually didn't even learn anything about death and dying and what happens when a patient is dying at the end of life. And, so I was a family medicine doctor, general practitioner, you might call it in Canada, and my own father died when I was in my 30s. So I had only been practicing in medicine for about 3 years. He died by suicide, which was very traumatic and devastating for me. And I was just really floundering in grief. And I spent 3 years trying to avoid my own grief, not think about it, not deal with it. And I wasn't getting through it. I wasn't dealing with it. I wasn't functioning very well. And I finally woke up one day and realized I'm taking the wrong approach. I'm trying to run away from grief. Maybe what I need to do is walk directly into it. And I thought hospice might be a place where I could do that. I'll go volunteer at a hospice. I'll be with people who are facing grief every day and facing death and dying. And maybe that's what I need. And the moment I got there as a volunteer and started working and seeing patients, it's like I had this aha, and I realized this is the kind of doctor I always wanted to be. If this is what I always wanted for my career, this is where I belong. And so it became apparent to me I needed to just shift my career over to start working in hospice, because it was so profound and so deeply meaningful to be with patients. And finally, I was in a place where I felt like I'm making a real difference in people's lives by doing this work. And I found I had a lot of capacity for it, but maybe that's because of the grief and the pain that I had dealt with over my father's death, that I could help other people in that situation.
Yeah, my God, that's amazing. So it started out as a way for you to cope with what you were going through, and it turned into finding your purpose in life.
Exactly, exactly. Much to my surprise, I had no idea that would happen.
Yeah, wow. And I know that comes up as one of the seven lessons in your book, so I do want to come down to that, because that's just an incredible origin story. The other thing that I think about, which is really what brought me to want to have you on the podcast and talk about this, is that I can't imagine doing this for a living and having watched hundreds of people pass away and it not have a profound impact on how you live your life. So how has that experience changed how you live your life?
It's really changed it in every way, because I think the first thing I recognized is life is incredibly fragile and fleeting, and it's over before we know it. And I realized how much I'd just been taking for granted. Like, I'm not going to do that today. I could do that next week. I'll worry about that later. And I realized I can't live that way anymore. I can't live where I take life for granted. I want to enjoy every moment of it. And especially with my children and my husband, like, I want to be here for each moment, because I learned that you can lose, things can be lost at any moment in time. And then also just learning that I needed to take care of my own business. I needed to take care of the unfinished things, especially like my old grudges and resentments and anger that I was carrying. I didn't want to spend my life energy carrying all that negativity. And so it became clear to me, like, I have to work on that every single day.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's just so interesting how, you know, your job is incredibly different from the jobs that I have or that the people listening have. But even as amazing as a job as that is, it's easy to get complacent. Like, you still get up and go to work every day, and I'm sure you find yourself getting pissed off with somebody in traffic or like falling into those same traps that you would think. I look at you and go, oh, she must just live in the present every day. She's reminded every day she goes to work how precious life is, but it still takes work.
Oh yeah. It's always still a roller coaster every day of ups and downs.
Right.
And, like, I had always kind of done a little bit of journaling, but I started journaling a lot more because I found I have all these emotions inside of me and that's where my stories came from, because I would write some of the things that were happening with patients that were really deep and intense. I would write about them in my journal. I would write about what I was learning and what was coming up for me with patients. And then I had also kind of dabbled in yoga a bit and done a little bit of meditation, but those became much more serious and regular because that's how what I needed in order to tend to myself, to just keep myself in a calm place and tend to my own emotions, just doing yoga and some meditation every day and the journaling. And that really helped me stay more stable and present.
Wow, I love that. Yeah, I've got this. It's interesting how the first kind of 2 hours of my day is usually a combination of those things you talked about. It's some meditation, it's yoga, it's journaling, it's exercise. It's just all to sort of, I don't know what it is, strip away, just like, and when those 2 hours are up, man, if I could live that way, I'm relaxed, I'm hopeful, I'm grateful, this man. And then, you know, I could be 20 minutes later and I'm, who knows what I'm ranting about. It's a constant battle for sure.
Yeah, I had a day exactly like that of then driving to work and getting cut off in traffic, and I'm yelling at the other driver, and I realize, oh wait, I lost that equanimity in a hurry, didn't I? So one more thing to journal about and figure out, why do I get so mad in traffic?
Yeah. That person that just gave me the finger, isn't that Dr. Karen Wyatt who wrote that book about
it could have been, to be honest.
That's awesome. But so I do want to talk about the book because, you know, there are lots of people in your line of work that haven't written a book. So what was it that made you decide, maybe this is, I need to get these out of my journal into something that I can share with the world?
Well, I think it was journaling, telling these stories, and I started to recognize patterns with some of my patients that I saw the most common things that people seem to be working on at the end of life, the tasks that they were trying to fulfill at the end of life. And as I looked back on all these stories and all the things I had written, I started thinking, I think I need to write about this. And for one thing, my whole life, I loved writing. And so I always, in my mind, I thought someday I will write a book. Like, that'll be my second career. I'm going to become a writer. So that was in the back of my mind. And as I saw these stories unfolding and it began to make sense that there are certain lessons here in these stories, I thought, that's what I need to write about. I knew that it had to be written. So eventually I retired from clinical practice in order to write the book because I couldn't get the writing done while I was doing the work. It was too hard. I didn't have the energy for it.
That just reminds me of a quote that I read recently and I just can't get it out of my head. Something to the effect that it may not be possible to know who you are without first expressing it. And I've been toying with, this is a bit of a tangent, but I've been doing more writing and flirting with the idea of writing a book. And I'm just finding that it's such an incredibly rewarding experience, this process of taking all of these ideas in your head and shaping it into something. Maybe I share it with the world, maybe I don't, but how cathartic and almost therapeutic that is. And I can't imagine I imagine that would be a really powerful thing, especially given the content that you're writing about in your experience with your dad and all the experiences you've had.
It's so very true. And a lot of the kind of healing realizations I had around my dad's death came through the process of writing that book. Mm. There were things I hadn't seen before or recognized before, but it was when I sat down to write it that, you know, almost every day, like, oh my gosh, I never even saw that before. I never even recognized that. So I was learning the entire time that I was writing it, and it was such a powerful experience.
Oh, I can't imagine. So your book is called What Really Matters, Seven Lessons for Living from Stories of the Dying. When I saw that title, I was like, oh my God, that's a book I've got to read. It's brilliant. And your seven lessons are suffering, love, forgiveness, presence, purpose, surrender, and impermanence. And so I'd love to dig into every one of those. We might not have time, but I think what really brings those things to life are some of the stories that you tell. So are there one or two stories that really resonated with you, or I don't know, I hate to say favorite stories, but some of the most powerful stories from the book?
I would say what I viewed for me, the most powerful stories all had to do with forgiveness. And that was one of the really pivotal lessons I was learning, because I saw every one of my patients in one way or another was dealing with forgiveness at the end of life, trying to forgive someone else or be forgiven for something that had happened in life. Mm. And there were so many stories, but one of the stories that I chose to share was, it was a family that had become estranged. That's a very common situation. The youngest brother of the family had been estranged from his two older brothers and had kind of been the prodigal son and gone off and lived on the streets, got involved in drugs. And the family really had disowned him, but he eventually got cancer and had nowhere to go and no one to care for him, and showed up on his brother's doorstep, and the brother started to turn him away and said, you know, I don't, you know, you're dead to me already. I don't care. But the brother's wife said, no, he's our family. We're caring for him. She brought him into the home and was giving him care at the end of his life. And then this really beautiful story of forgiveness happened as the older brother, who had rejected his younger brother, watched his wife caring for his ill brother every day and the sacrifices that she made and how beautiful it was. And at one point, he ended up, his brother fell on the floor and couldn't get up. The older brother picked him up and carried him back to bed. And just that moment of holding his younger brother, which he had done when his younger brother was a baby and when they were children, it completely wiped away the anger and the resentment that had been between them. And they completely restored their relationship before the younger brother died. And it was so beautiful to see it. And it just happened in the moment. You know, no one was trying to teach them, you should forgive each other and this is how to do it. It happened because the older brother, his wife couldn't pick him up. The older brother bent down and picked up his younger brother and just held him in his arms. And there was this amazing moment of total forgiveness between them. And it was just profound to watch these things unfold and to hear the stories from the families.
Why do you think that story resonated with you personally so much?
I guess it was because I had witnessed a lot of this, the power, like families are tricky, families are tough, and we do hold on to lots of resentments. And I've seen it so often, even in my own family, of relatives of mine become estranged and not speak to each other for 20 years, and how much pain that brings. But to see that it can all be turned around in a moment. You may have 20 years of tangled emotions and anger and bad experiences, but all it takes is one instant, one loving act like that, and it can transform everything so quickly. That was a huge lesson, that it's never too late, and that even in the very last moments of life, that kind of healing and reconciliation can happen.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that I think about often is, you know, when we lose somebody or we feel, I had this happen, not with somebody pass away, but recently my son got really sick and it was a really scary few days. And in an instant when he got his diagnosis. Like, everything changes. Like, all of the things that kept me up at 3 a.m. were gone. Like, I forgot about the deliverables, all the things I was worried about, my bills, my, you know, whatever it was. And the only thing that mattered was my family and my son, and a clarifying moment of what really matters. And I lived in this, my wife and I kind of lived in this pocket for like a week, right? Where it was just all about him. And there was a sort of a beauty in it. Because I usually experience that when somebody dies, like when my dad died, and it was a pocket of time. And I've often thought, like, wouldn't it be amazing to live this present, live in this gratitude every day for the rest of your life? But my experience is it's 3 days. With my son, it lasted a little longer. But on the fourth day, yeah, I'm awake at 3 a.m. I'm worried about the same shit I was. And I think your book is sort of like it's almost a way of a reminder of, you do these 7 things and you get closer to living in that pocket, but it's so fragile. it just evaporates so quickly.
It is. It's so true. And I start with just that very question, what really matters? So when I'm in traffic and someone cuts me off, if I can pause for 1 second and ask myself, okay, does this really matter? Is this really worth my attention and my energy and my anger right now? Because there are a million things that don't really matter that confront us constantly in our lives. And the more I ask myself that question, I can stop and say, no, this doesn't matter. Let that go. Don't worry about it. But it's a constant practice. Like, that becomes the practice every day,
right?
is trying to figure out, how do I stay in that clarity where I can see so clearly what matters and let go of all the things that don't matter?
Yeah, clarity. I love that. Yeah, I'd like to think I'm getting better, but as I said, I still can have my 2 hours of practice and getting all set for the day. And then 20 minutes later, my middle finger is up in a fraction of a second. Like, it's a reflex. And of course, you know, 10 seconds later, I feel like the biggest, you know, asshole in the world. I'm like, what is wrong with you? You were just, you had spent 2 hours trying to be a great person.
It's a crucial 2 hours. It's just the fact that you're trying is what makes all the difference, you know, and that you're aware, oh, wait, I slipped off the equanimity path there.
Yeah, that's right. So some other things from the book that really, I mean, every one of those 7 lessons I took something away from, but there were a couple that really spoke to me. And you shared a number of stories of people that kind of had regrets at the end of their lives. And a lot of them were that they didn't spend enough time with family, or that they focused on their career at the expense of other things that they wanted to do. And no matter how many times I hear this, again, I struggle with it. I think a lot of us struggle with finding that balance. So do you have any stories that really stand out on that?
Yeah. This is kind of what I came away from, because I struggled too with the idea of, how do I know what my purpose is? And how do I know if I'm fulfilling my purpose every day? And even wondering, my dad, who ended his own life early, did he fulfill his purpose before he died? Or what happens? Are there people who don't fulfill their purpose in life? And so one of the things that became clear to me through my patients is that no matter what you do, what you choose, what path you choose or you're on, if your motivation is somehow based on love, that you do what you do because you love your life, or you love other people, or you love something, you can't go wrong if love is part of your motivation. And the people I saw with the biggest regrets were people who had made choices. I mean, I saw a woman who was an avid exerciser and lived on a really rigid, strict diet, but all because she was afraid of getting cancer one day. And she believed if she adhered to this really rigid lifestyle, she would never get sick. And of course, she got cancer, and she was so bitter and angry. But that told me she wasn't doing those things out of a love for her life. She was doing it out of fear because she was so afraid of developing an illness. on the other side of that, you know, I had a patient who was an avid marathoner, and he ran marathons and trained all the time, but he absolutely loved running. He loved everything about it and was full of joy. And so he devoted his life to running, but it brought him nothing but joy and pleasure. And he shared that with his family. It was all based on love, not on fear. So what that told me is, our motivation for the work we do and for everything that we do in our life has to somehow come from our joy and our love of being alive, not our fear that something bad will happen. And we don't regret it. If we've done it out of love, we won't have any regrets about the choices that we've made. So I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh my God, that speaks to me so much, Karen, because, and I was just having this conversation with a friend yesterday, this idea of purpose that you mentioned, this pressure, especially, you know, like, as I like to say, I'm in the autumn of my career, this kind of pressure that I think a lot of people feel like, what is my purpose? What am I supposed to do? I'm running out of time to realize my purpose and live with purpose. And I know it's supposed to be this enlightening, inspiring thing, but it's the opposite. It makes a lot of people feel like they're not doing enough. And maybe it's not so much about purpose as to the why you're doing whatever you're doing. And if you're doing it for the right reasons, you're doing it to be of service to people, or you're doing it for love instead of fear, maybe that's all the purpose you need. And maybe you come to some big realization like you did, that your purpose in life is to help people die with dignity. But maybe we're asking the wrong question.
Yeah, exactly. And even for me, I went to a deeper level kind of spiritually, that what I'm here for in a spiritual way is to learn more about love. And so it doesn't matter if I do that by being a hospice doctor or just being a mom or writing a book, or even if I just sit at home and read books or go for walks and meditate, I can be learning about love and bringing more love to the world no matter what I do. And that just helped me reprioritize everything, and also not be so afraid, because one of my fears was, what if I become ill? If my purpose is to be a hospice doctor, what if I become ill and I can't do it? Then I'm not fulfilling my purpose. What will happen then?
Right.
But then I realized, no, it's not the actual choice of the career path. That's part of it. That was a huge way for me to learn about how to give and receive love. But I can keep doing that no matter what else. Even if I'm recording podcasts at home, I'm still in that place of giving and receiving love. I don't have to always do the same work that I thought before was my purpose. If, you know, I can shift paths and I can change careers, and I'm still fulfilling what I came here to do.
You're right. I think a lot of people do, as me and my friends, more and more people that I talk to are sort of can see the end of the tunnel, and they're like, yeah, I thought my purpose was being a teacher or doing whatever. And now if I'm not that, what am I? And I really like that, because I think that is definitely something that a lot of us, if we don't, that's sort of what forces us to find our purpose, is that we've sort of just kind of assumed that it's the job that we like. And maybe that's enough purpose for me until that job goes away, and then we're sort of left stranded.
Yeah. And it frees you up. If you can think of, what is my deeper purpose, like my deeper spiritual reason that I came here, that I really need to learn about in this in this lifetime, I can do that in any job. I can do that in any situation. Even if I'm sick and I'm in a hospital bed, I could still work on this. I could still do it. I could still be fulfilling my purpose and learning. That was very comforting for me to have that realization.
Yeah. One of the other things that you talk about in the book, the themes that really resonated with me, was this idea that of living authentically, right? How many people that, and you share stories in the book of, they wish they had pursued their passions rather than kind of doing what society expected them to do or what their friends and peers were expecting them to do. And I think about that a lot. Yeah, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I see that. I've seen so many people who've told me that. And I think because our society has such expectations of us, and we all learn about those expectations at a pretty young age, rather than learning to listen to ourselves, like listen to our own intuition or reflect on what do I enjoy or what do I feel or what urges do I have to do certain things in life? And again, our society doesn't help us with that at all, because we're taught to kind of ignore our intuition and do what everyone else thinks would be a good job for us or a good path for us. So that goes along with that idea of being in a place of love and joy, but being able to reflect upon what you're feeling inside. And so I think many times we don't get a chance to even get to know ourselves. We don't get to know our own inner world and our intuition unless we work at that. And that's where journaling comes in, because you end up writing your deeper thoughts and those deeper emotions that start arising during the day. Anything we can do to know ourselves better is going to help us to become that authentic person, because we'll start to recognize that's not really me. That's not really what I feel inside. That's something someone else told me I should do or how I should behave.
It's something that I think a lot about as my two sons are kind of in their 20s, right? And so they're in college and they're doing different things. And, you know, my older son is in third year, so he's thinking about getting a job. And I'm like, is he doing this because he really loves to, or because we've just sort of conditioned him that he goes to high school, he took a gap year, he went to college, now he gets a job, you know, like, and I think back on my experience, like, yeah, I don't remember ever reflecting or anything. It's just things that I was expected to do. I was going to university. I had good enough marks to go to the university. I was the first kid in my family in generations anyway to go to school. I had the chance, I was going. I don't have a great answer for it, but it's something I'm very mindful of as I see my kids follow through a very predictable path. I'm like, God, I hope I didn't pave this road for them that they don't feel like they've had some choice in this.
There's kind of a formula set out for us of, you know, what you should do or you're expected to do. You know, I had the fortune, because I'm old, much older than you are now, you know, of having an inspiration to become a doctor at a time when there weren't very many women doctors. And my parents were able to support that and encourage me to do that, which was unusual and surprising at that time in the world, you know, when women were discouraged from having professional careers. But I look back and think, wow, that was a profound blessing for me that I had parents that would allow me to find my own path and choose that for myself, even though at the time it was unconventional. Not now, though, because there are lots of women doctors now.
Yeah. Are there any other stories from the book that you think would be, you know, particularly help drive home some of those key themes, maybe ones that we haven't talked about yet?
So when we're talking about, you know, being authentic and learning who you are, one of the patients we cared for that I wrote about in the book was a man who had been homeless for much of his life. He'd been a vagrant and kind of traveled on trains from different parts of the country. You know, he'd hop on trains, go from here and there, and so lived on the streets in various different communities for most of his life. And we ended up taking care of him at the end of his life as a charity care patient, because he had no one else who could look after him. And someone donated a little apartment where he could be cared for. And he was only expected to live for 2 weeks. But it turns out in his little apartment where he was spending time alone every day, he had a spiral notebook and a pencil, and he started making drawings of things he had seen in his travels. And he'd never drawn anything in his life before. For some reason, he just started doing it to pass the time. And it turns out he was an incredible artist and had never known that about himself. And so this man, who was expected to die in 2 weeks, actually ended up living for an entire year, and he drew pictures every single day. And he was inspired because he he discovered himself in that process and discovered, oh my goodness, I have a talent. I'm really good at this. I didn't even know it. And he was so excited to fulfill that talent that it actually kept him going for much longer than we thought it would. And so again, it's that idea that it's never too late. And so, you know, even at certain ages, we think, oh, I wish I should have done this years ago. Why didn't I do it back then? Because I'm running out of time now, but not so. You can change anything at any moment and find out who you are and discover a new talent and pursue that. So never think that you've run out of time and there's not enough time to become who you really are.
Yeah, that is definitely, as I was, you know, going through the book, I was reflecting on it. And I've thought about this before, like, what is some of my biggest fears? And I don't think I'm afraid of dying as much as getting to the end of my life and realizing that I didn't do something, you know, that I'm not the man that my kids, you know, deserved, or that I didn't do something that I have always wanted to do. And that does help provide a sense of urgency on some things. Like, for example, I've been kind of toying with, you know, writing a book like you did. And it's something that comes up and I dismiss it. Yeah, maybe I'll do it someday. Or I don't want to do it when I'm 70 and wish I had done it when I'm 50. Like, if it's worth doing, why isn't it worth doing now? And it doesn't mean that I'm doing everything that I've always wanted to do right now, because that is kind of sometimes what I feel. And sometimes my friends are like, can you slow down, man? Like, you can't do all this stuff at once. But it does help me prioritize and things, and helps me realize, yes, this is actually something really important. And if it's worth doing, it's worth doing now. So I love that idea.
And one thing I didn't realize in writing a book was that I thought I had to know everything before I could start to write the book. And I realized you learn what you need to know as you're writing it.
Right.
So don't let that discourage you if you feel like, I'm not sure I know enough, because you'll learn so much in the process.
Yeah. The other thing that I was reflecting on, it's so interesting. I mean, I don't know if the seven lessons are necessarily, you know, they're not a roadmap for life. It's not the meaning of life. But I was sort of thinking about all of these do sort of speak to, at least me, trying to figure out, you know, what am I here for? What is the meaning of life? How can I be the person that I was supposed to be in the, you know, 80 or 90 short years that I've got here? And it seems to me, like, reading your book, it's like the ultimate irony is that everybody figures this out. You just have to wait till the very end until you figure it out. And so your book is a way of saying, let's take what these people that are dying, let's take these lessons and try to figure it out before the final light goes out, and to try to live your way, live life more meaningfully. I thought, God, that what an amazing idea for a book.
You're exactly right. You got it exactly right that when I decided to write it, I mean, I wrote it for myself in a sense of deciding, I want to learn these things now. I don't want to be on my deathbed working through some of these issues. I know it can happen. I mean, I know it's possible, but I'd like to learn this now, and I'd like to live this way right now. So I want to figure out how to do that, and what it takes, and how I could possibly do a better job with some of these concepts now, earlier in my life. And so I wrote it thinking maybe other people will feel that way too, and will hope that they could learn something earlier in life and not wait until the very end.
Yeah. I just picture myself lying there, you know, as my eyes close for the first time, be like, yes, I get it. I got it. put me back in, coach. It's like, yeah, I've got some good news and I got some bad news. You're going to figure out the answers to life. And the bad news is,
there may not be. I actually had patients say to me, I just now figured out what life is really about. And they said, I don't have time to tell anyone else. And that's another inspiration for the book. I had a few patients say, would you remember my story and would you write about it? Because you can tell people, I won't be able to. And so part of it was fulfilling that promise to patients as well.
Yeah, that's beautiful. okay, I could talk about this forever. And this is exactly what I was hoping for, Karen, because again, there's nothing depressing or, nothing depressing about this conversation. It's just so enlightening. Things that I aspire to do every day, lessons that I aspire to learn. I absolutely love the idea for the book. I love this conversation. One thing that I'm curious about, what are you most excited about next?
Well, I have a couple more books I want to write, including fiction. For some reason, I'm like inspired to try to write fiction. And I'm also a grandmother, and it's been amazing watching grandchildren grow up and playing a different role than being the mother. It's really nice to be one step removed as a grandmother. So I'm very excited about my grandchildren. But then for my own tasks, writing a couple more books, I would really like to be able to complete that.
Yeah, that's amazing. And tell me about the podcast.
Well, yeah, I should have included that as well, because I actually started the podcast after I wrote the book, because I discovered that nobody wanted to talk to me about the book back then. It made people so uncomfortable. And I thought, oh, wow, we have to start at the very beginning. Like we have to. And I realized, what if I have conversations with people about death? And initially I posted them on my website because I hadn't heard of podcasts. I didn't know how to do that. So I recorded conversations with people about death, put them on my website. And then when I learned about podcasts, I uploaded them all into a podcast format and then started doing it as a podcast, thinking, you know, I can create these conversations that are going to be out there available to people who might just stumble across it and find it. And if people who are afraid of death can hear me and another person talking about it in such a comfortable way and sharing what we've learned and how valuable it is, maybe that will help them with their fear.
It's sort of like, it feels like the last taboo, right? Where it's just the one thing that we still don't talk about enough. And I've been reflecting and preparing for this conversation, thinking about it a lot. It's the book and this conversation have meant so much to me, Karen. I can't thank you enough for this.
Oh, you're so very welcome. Well, it means so much to me because, again, as you know, over the years, struggling to find readers for the book who will get it and be excited about it. So it's really nice to get to talk to you about it.
Yeah, thank you so much. I will include in the show notes your links to your podcast, your book, where people can learn more about the amazing things you do and all the great stuff you put out into the world. So this has been awesome. Thanks again.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
The Growth Mixtape podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.